For more than three decades, James Erdang has worked in the cross-section between education, civil society, and social change in South Africa. As the founder of Education Africa, his work has been rooted in a simple but powerful idea. Education is still one of the most effective ways to break the cycle of poverty. But what makes his perspective particularly valuable is not just the work, it's the time horizon. Because over these 30 years, he has witnessed the evolution of South Africa's education system from the early days of transformation to where we find ourselves today. And the question in our conversation is not so much the journey, but what this journey has produced. You were mentored by leaders like Walter Sisulu, and you come from a time when the mission around education in South Africa was well understood as being part of the nation building. And the words education transformation meant something in that moment. Do you think that there was a sense of urgency back then and a sense of clarity about what was needed to be preserved as well as what was needed to be changed?
So I can talk on the education front on that particular issue, but I'm very proud to also say that I was supported and mentored by our first chairman, who was the great nation builder, which is Dr. Agri Claster from the Sowetan in the time of the first chair of Education Africa, yeah.
Wow.
But obviously, Sisulu changed my life forever, embraced me as a young guy, and created opportunities that I think mind-boggling when I look back now, especially with the book. There was an urgency in South Africa, I think, when the transformation came and the violence and third forces and that were involved, and it was a killing field. And we forget that. But I think the urgency really came in the assassination of Chris Hani. I think South Africa leadership of the country changed on that very day. It wasn't a clerk who came forward on television. It was Nelson Mandela. So the ANC had taken over leadership role there. And I think that's what I think brought our democracy a lot quicker. I think it would have been dragged on a lot more through CODESA, and we're already on. And it could be shown even by the Constitution, that the Constitution was only adopted 2 years later. There was an urgency to get to the election. But there were challenges, especially on the education front, and those challenges had to be addressed and had to be addressed with urgency. I don't believe they still have. And the difference is pre-94 and after 94, let's say up to the first term of President Mbeki, there was patience. There's no more patience. In fact, because of the economy and service delivery, et cetera, over the last 20 years, economic growth has been outstripped by population growth. So people are actually getting poorer in the middle class. And the only way you're going to fix it is by tackling education. Yes, there's short-term interventions, but you need long-term. We can't leave the poor of the poor out of the system, which they are.
So, you know, you're talking about the work that you do as Education Africa, having worked alongside this education system in South Africa throughout the past 30 years. And for decades, you've either been supporting it or filling in gaps in the system. What have you learned about how the system actually works on the ground that you think people don't quite understand about our education system?
Well, our education system, I think what's got not understand is that there's been no political will to change education in 30 years. You had President Ramaphosa doing the right thing last year in apologising, not taking early childhood development seriously. That was on the 17th of March, and the launch of the Bandapele program, which is good in areas, but I think it also excludes the poor of the poor further. So I think people are angry in a way because there's no access. I think for a black child today still, which I think is terrible, is to get a quality education. It's still about beating the system. which is not acceptable. If you look at how can we give ourselves a tick as a country when at 10 years old, grade fours, 80% of our children can't read for meaning. Then they're asking, why is math so bad? Hey, guys, if you can't read for meaning, maths is another language. Mm. So imagine if you can't do English or European thing. Language. Yeah, language. Then you've got to, how are you going to learn this new language?
You talk about there not being political will to change. But year on year, and every term, I suppose, every five-year term cycle, we hear about strategies for changes. We hear about investment in this sector. We talk about expanded interventions. Just this past weekend with the new MEC for Education here in Gauteng, you know, they revealed their 2025 to 2030 education strategy. So these interventions, these strategies, these expanded, all of these things, they keep talking about them, and yet the outcomes remain deeply uneven. From your point of view, from your vantage point, where does the system fail to convert this investment, this energy, into tangible outcomes?
So first of all, we've got to say one thing about education. It has the biggest slice of the budget. So people can't say there's not enough money. There's enough money. It's how it's used. But there's mismanagement, which has got to be dealt with. Cater deployment that has to be dealt with. And you must remember, if you want to change education, you need the political decision that I said earlier. And the political decision is you're going to have to take on SATU. That's never been done. So it's the biggest union in South Africa. A lot of those teachers are teachers for ends from means, not because of themselves. Because of the Ubuntu apartheid system, they're still filtering through. So you had very limited job opportunities. It wasn't a calling. So they've got to go back to grassroots. And I think you can't have a five-year vision in education. You've got to have a long-term vision, because whatever you implement normally takes around 7 years to start seeing results. It's not a quick fix, but there are quick gains you can have. Ah. Quick gains, for example, holding teachers responsible. At any one time, 10% of teachers aren't in school. 10% of our children aren't in school, the teachers aren't in school. And you can't paint the same paintbrush against everybody. So that's from a, it's a 20 or 30, I haven't got the stat, 30%. That is extremely high. If you went at podcast party for at any one time for 10% of your year, would you have a job here?
I definitely wouldn't have an audience.
No. And they, and this whole thing is that you've got legislature school days.
Mm.
Government does not keep to those legislature school days. So it's impossible for you to keep. So when I was at school and you go into school, you write exams up to the last day of school. That doesn't happen anymore. Schools are losing up to 5 weeks a year, 25 days a year, because teachers won't mark in the holidays. So in July, you start writing the mid-year exams and the kids aren't at school because the teachers are marking. Those are legislative school days. At the end of the year, it can be up to 3 weeks, sometimes even 4 weeks. If we are paying those salaries, teachers, yes, are hardworking, but not everyone. It's the same as a corporate. You get good and bad. In government, you get good and bad. But we're talking about, hey, guys, if you're going to be losing teachers who aren't working, you've got school days not adhered to, you're losing those days. These are quick fixes. But these are... SATU's going to have to listen to that and agree to that.
And so you're talking about areas where the system has become weakened. And I'm also interested to know, have we got anything right in the past 30 years? Is there areas where the system has been
South Africa's done very well in the ANC government. Let's give them credit there in universal education at primary school level. But then we unpack it, and I do take my hat off to the government that we participate in the TIMSS benchmarking. I don't know if you know what that is. So it's some benchmarking globally of maths and science. Where do we come in the world? Stone last. But we participate, and I think these things are important. So it's recognised. The overall, I think there's been a decline, and I think there's going to be a continuous decline if it's the ANC now and these new policies, because there's got to be hard decisions made, as I said, and you've got to fix up the quick fixes first, and there's long-term things. There's also the positive, as I said, with President Ramaphosa with the Bundapele program. But you must remember the Bundapele excludes now the poor of the poor.
Why?
So if you bought into poverty, you're not going to get a subsidy from government. So what Ramaphosa said is that I'm going to increase now the subsidy per child from 18 Rand to 24 Rand a day. But Joe Public doesn't understand that. So you've got the Bundapele program, so you've got the three levels of bronze, silver, gold. Bronze is just a mass registration. And I think that needs to be done. We need to know where these schools are, what's going on, et cetera. So it really needs to be done. But for you to get out of bronze, to get to silver, to start getting a bit of incentives, and you've got to have your land issue sorted. That's mainly municipal. So in other words, I'm sitting in informal settlement. I'm born into poverty, so my government's not going to help me. And that's the majority of South Africans. They're not going to get help. And there's, to me, the most important where these schools should be supported is once they've got a level four, NCAF level four teacher. Because, and then there's a whole debate around that. Because I'd be happy to be under a tree or in a shack with a good teacher. Why must I be in a nice structure with a poor teacher? Who has the right to exclude me from a system because I'm poor, because I was born into poverty? Who has that right? I've got a fundamental right, and all children in this country, to access to a quality education.
And you talk about the fact that the problem is not money. The problem is not money. It's misalignment, it's misappropriation. The money exists in the system. And talking about TIMSS and the global benchmarks, you know, when you think about how much is spent per pupil in South Africa or per learner in South Africa as compared to other global South, even African countries, what with fewer resources, they are doing so much better than us. What do you think they are getting right that we are not?
Look, I don't know enough about the education system on the continent, but I was even at UNISA yesterday, and we got the music department, and they're saying how the top achievers actually come from Uganda, not from South Africa. The one thing I'd also say, I cover in my book Dr. Zingai Mutambuku, who was the first minister of education under Robert Mugabe, who I worked with, and he went over to the World Education Desk, and I was the liaison between them and the ANC.
Wow.
And I learned a lot. That's where I learned a hell of a lot from him. But hey, when the liberation struggle was on in Zimbabwe, kids went to school under trees in Mozambique. They weren't denied an education. If you're under 18, you went to school. If you had to leave. They've got brilliant teachers, brilliant schools. And he was credited for building, got the communities to build schools. Were those schools built to the top SABS standards? No, not all of them. But the reality, get the kids into school. Don't deny them an education. Don't deny them an education.
And do you think that as a society, we are honest enough about where the problems in the system are? Are we honest with ourselves about the problems in the system, about the mismanagement, about the lack of school days and attendance, the denying kids access to the schooling, about teachers not showing up? Are we honest about having this conversation, or is it something that we are looking away from and hoping somebody somewhere in government will solve?
I think government, I've been to some things where they seem to be omniscient, say what it is, but that nothing gets done about it. But you've got people who I look up to, like Professor Jonathan Janssen. I mean, he can package it so better than I, and I can give one example of Professor Janssen. Is I was listening to him, and he said half the kids fall out of school before matric. And I've always said, well, I'm a bit more conservative, so from grade 2 to standard to grade 10, I say 150,000. And in that last 3 years, 250,000 are pushed out of the system. The reality is saying around 600,000. So it's give or take. I mean, these are massive numbers. But then the honesty the public doesn't understand. So unless you're Jonathan Janssen, and obviously there's a lot of bright, Mary Metcalf, there's a lot of bright people around. And that's, I believe, with public-private partnerships, and that you could actually change education. I think the experts are here. You don't need to get on an aeroplane to go to Europe, because I don't believe that we need a European system. We got outcome-based education. It was a disaster. They warned not to do it.
Mm.
We need to find solutions for our people. Mm. But if you look at that, the smudge on that now, if you look at the new DA Minister of Education, I was very impressed when I met her at a conference at
Siviwe.
Minister Khwarube. When I met her as an event at Investec, and she spoke about the matric pass rate. She talked about the bachelor pass. She ignored the overall pass. So she said there's been improvement. This was last year, beginning of last year. There's been an improvement in the bachelor pass from 46 to 47%. And I thought, you know what? This woman's great. She's telling it like it is. Because I didn't get a matric. I got a school leaving certificate. I didn't get 50%. Below that should not be a pass. And I'm only carry on there if you give me
minutes. Yeah, carry on.
Is that when the year started getting out last year, you started to see her conversation changing and talking about overall matric pass rate. And when the matric results were published this year, she said it's the best ever. That is the biggest load of nonsense. And that's where the public doesn't understand. First of all, her bachelor pass went from 47% back to 46%. 34% of the kids registered for core maths or pure maths. Same percentage of that failed. So you had about 20% who passed.
Sure.
Okay. Then, wait. We didn't talk about half the kids that were pushed out the system, so you take that pass away. Then you take away those who got 60% in maths and science and higher, because that's what's good for business subjects, which are when you need even your 70s and 80s for medicine engineering. You're talking about a few percent, and then generally you need maths and science. So now you're going to, 30,000 kids, including the whites in the country?
So we're being misled.
I admit there's a misunderstanding, and I think there's got to be a stronger vocal thing around that. So I think there's that same flag that's been waved on this, and it's a tragedy. I mean, there's got to be a massive intervention in reading. There's got to be a massive intervention in maths, but before Standard 9, it's got to come in the primary schools, or you're not going to see change.
Well, here you talk about you only got a school leaving certificate and you are a vibrant and successful and contributing member of society. Do you think that we've not aligned our education system with the realities of our economy and what the economy needs and what we're trying to build? There's a misalignment. We're just not...
There's no alignment.
These two conversations
There's no alignment.
No alignment.
There's no alignment. I'm sorry. If we go back to Bengu, who was Minister Bengu, I was very fond of him and worked well. He taught me a lot. Great man. But Bengu made a mistake with the redeployment of maths and English teachers, etc. So I was sitting in a nice place in Cape Town. You go off to rural Transkei, Limpopo. There was a mass exodus, and they took the packages. You made a mistake. Learn from your mistakes and listen. Then came Cader Asmal. Cader Asmal closed the teacher training colleges. So you had to go to the universities for that. Today we've got more teachers retiring than are being trained. The teachers that are being trained at universities aren't getting enough practical.
So they don't have time in front of students?
Not enough time. They do have time, but not enough time. So the whole push after 1994, and Bunter education was crime against humanity, and we're going to pay for generations for that. So let's not go into that. I think all South Africans are aware of that. But what's happened since in 30 years that we couldn't change things? Because it's also been pushed to academic. You've got an academic flow through this country. You only most probably need 30% on the academic side. You need 70% on the technical side. And then you would have seen change. You would have seen the economic growth that comes with it, and you'll see a lower unemployment. So that change has also got to come through. We've got kids at university fighting to get into university. Human resources. It's not going to help the country. A few people get jobs, which is wonderful, and I'd love to see every child in this country get a job. But it's not going to come through going to university and human resources.
So what do you think, is there a role then that business, you were talking about partnership, private-public partnerships earlier, is there a role then for business in terms of creating opportunities for high wage, skill base priorities in the economy, in their organizations, outside of the academitized system?
The business, through your BEE and your skills development and enterprise development, there's a lot being done. And South Africans pay already a hard tax, and these are indirect taxes as well. So there's a lot being done. But it's limited for the size of population, what we need. There's got to be the change in economic policy, which we saw under Mbeki and Mandela, and then you saw the big growth. You've got to get rid of this red tape. I think President Ramaphosa did a fantastic thing, I think it was last week or the week before, where your civil service will be now appointed by your civil service, not political appointment. Mm. And so you start creating a professional civil service. So there are things that he's doing, but it's going to take time to filter through, and there's a lot of things that are still being done wrong. Mm. And we're a different country, but we haven't got the time. I always say that I'm a radical optimist. I'm a proud South African. I'm a proud African. But let's be straight, and things will come right, but there's always can tip. Majority of our population live in poverty. I'll give you a good example. I'm going to ask you, Pumi, a question. Am I allowed to ask a question?
Oh, sir.
And
answer honestly.
Okay. What percentage of Indians in India live in poverty, so under $1.80 a day?
In India?
India. Percentage, not...
Not overall number, because there's a billion
that'll be more, there's 1.3, whatever. But the percentage, because you've got to do apples with apples, you can't do, so obviously it's more their people, but the percentage.
Sure, in India, I would bet probably about 30%.
Okay, 4%. In South Africa, 2/3.
60%.
66%.
4%.
Under $1.80 a day. Okay, the number's bigger, but it's just saying that they're transforming quicker. South Africa, you've got 2/3 of this country living abject poverty. We're sitting here in Sandhurst. You don't see it. You look out your window, you see these beautiful buildings, you see this. I'm in the financial sector. It's great. What happens when someone says in the peri-urban areas or says in the young people, I've had enough, I want a piece of the power? That's the risk South Africa says. We can have our spring. I don't think it'll happen and I hope it won't happen. But we've got to weigh up these risks and we've got to say, how do we bring these people in? And over the medium to long term, it's going to be about fixing and changing the education system and being equitable. That because I was born into poverty doesn't mean that I'm going to be denied an education.
Let's bring this into the future, a little bit of futurescaping. You've spent the past 30 years of your life really trying to use education as a tool to break this poverty and the cycle of poverty that we're talking about. And if we were ultimately to think about it, education is not just for the sake of, right? It really is about where it leads to, the life that it leads to, the work that is available. Do you think that the system, as it currently is helping your mission or hampering your mission?
It's not helping our mission. I think a lot of the nonprofit sector on their own, there's a lot of more initiatives bringing in the private sector, which I think is good. I think governments are starting to realize they can't do it alone. They bring on people onto, for example, in Bandapele, you'll see private sector involved. But I can give an example. I like to give my own examples because they're true examples. So I can't say I'm speculating. I read it somewhere.
Yeah,
we've got a school in Orange Farm. And proud to say that this year we're celebrating our 30th anniversary.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's a high-performing school. And we get in the 60% for bachelor passes, not at 46%. Wow. Last year, we got 88 distinctions in the middle of Orange Farm. We got over 1,250 kids. This is a Category 1 area. Government should be putting in
more. We don't know what
more,
a Category 1 area
so
is.
So these are the poorer areas. They're in categories. So you could have a nice facility in a Category 1 area, and they go up to, I think it's 8. We work Category 1, which is the poorest of areas. And that's how your subsidies to these schools work. Okay. So you've got black schools there. We're a black school, and black kids and beautiful parents, but parents who can just about afford the stipend that we charge. So we partnered with St. John's College. We strive to get a quality education for all our children. It's a perfect example of what a public-private partnership can be if the government partner takes on its full responsibility. So what I'm saying is that government will subsidize independent subsidized school to the maximum of 60% of what they cost them to put a child through a non-fee paying school.
Mm.
That makes sense. Mm. That makes absolute sense. They cut the subsidy by 20%. That put our parents at risk. A lot of parents have had to leave because you now have charged 2,000 rand a year more. And we run the school on a thing. There should be more money. But no, they'll be happy to build now a non-fee paying school down the road, build the school which they're going to have to pay for, maintain that school which they're going to have to pay for, plus pay 100% of the fee. Where's the economics in that? So if you look at Gauteng, and that's why the MEC must tell the truth, they cut the Gauteng subsidy. So Treasury gives 1.08 billion to subsidies for the rand, okay? And that's been stagnant. They said they had to cut it because there's more schools now that they have to subsidize. Okay. So now they're putting, at our time, I think there's about 44 Category 1 schools, somewhere around there, that were put at risk of closure. These are the top black schools.
Sure.
Okay. Mounts worked it out, so most probably of that is lost about, between the schools, most probably about 200 million.
Sure.
A couple of months later, what did Gauteng Department of Education do? They had to send back to Treasury 3 billion of unspent money. There's no discussion within the department or understanding the department and one talking to other that we, hey, Treasury, we got to move 200 million to keep our top schools open and we can, so we can resend you back 2.8 billion.
Mm.
This is unspent. But the Western Cape sorted it out. They redirected from. Why can't they do it in Gauteng? Mm-hmm. And there's always this excuse that there's this immigration into Gauteng and the Western Cape.
Absolutely.
How come Western Cape are dealing with it and Gauteng can't deal with it?
So there's a dishonesty in the system too.
Well, there's a silence.
Is
I wouldn't
there?
Say dishonesty because I think dishonesty is a bit of harsh. Dishonesty to me, you think, but there's a silence.
Mm.
And there's not going out the MNC and say, I'm going to deal with this. We sent back 3 billion last year. Mm. I really apologize for that. And I'm going to make sure that we get the subsidized schools back their subsidies so we can keep those kids. Because you've got to create a system where you're lifting people up to the highest level, not just platooning things out. Because then, and that's the system's been eroded because of that. The system's been, and there's going to be this continuous erosion. So ours is a typical public-private partnership, and a lot of schools in here.
And it's a working.
And it's working, and you're getting good results. Maybe you're not getting the world-class results or this, but you're getting good results on benchmarking against anything in government. But government will tell you, I'm going to cut your subsidy completely if you don't get more than an 88% pass rate.
Sure.
Okay? They're going to cut these school subsidies. But it's not. It's comparing rotten bananas with a nice Granny Smith apple. And I'll tell you why. Because we've talked, our attrition at our school in these schools are very low. We government's sitting at 50%. So they're not telling that. These schools are excelling in maths and other key area subjects. Government schools aren't. So how can you say that I'm going to cut your subsidy if you don't get a 0.1% more than we're getting on average? There's no thought. And I think these schools, and you shouldn't be pushing today. I always say we should get 100% pass rate at our school. We won't get that anymore. It's where's the quality? The quality is in the bachelor. That's what your pass is. And the quality is in your subject choices that you're teaching. You can't say I've got a quality system when 2/3 of your kids are doing maths lit. And the 34% or 34.1% who are taking core, the equivalent amount of failing, so you're getting the 20, and then you're not even taking into account those being pushed out of the systems and not allowed to write matric.
And they're not ready for the workplace either on the other side.
No, not at all. And so I think because you're born into poverty, so I found with a lot of kids, which is very hard, is they leave school and this is the way life is. It's a norm. It's come a norm in South Africa. So I'm in poverty. I'm stuck in poverty, and it shouldn't be that way. And I think business, I believe in a free market economy, very strong belief in it, but I do believe in a different free market economy for South Africa because we do need BE, and so it's got to be done in a different way. I'm not an expert in that. You can speak to the economists, I'll do that. We've got to bring in people.
I want to ask about the parent. You know, I remember when my child started school, one of the first kind of teacher-parent meetings that we were told about this triangle that is the system, right? That's the school, the teachers, and the parents, the home, and society at large.
Mm.
And in your experience, the role of parents in the way that the education system has fallen apart, how much should also be given to the parents as a responsibility in who they hold accountable, in how they show up to meetings, and what it is that they do to support the school, to support the teachers, to support the system.
It's critical that the parents are involved with their children. Absolutely critical. I think even if you go to the well of schools, I mean, it's parents says, I've got my kid at this fancy independent schools, not my responsibility. I'm paying them a couple of 100,000 rand a year. That is nonsense. parent has to be involved. And obviously, the more you get into the peri-urbans and rural areas, the parents less involved, sadly. And a lot of that's economics. A lot of that's their own education backgrounds, which some of them are embarrassed by. But I always say that even if you're literate as a parent, go sit next to your kid and listen to them read. They might be reading wrong. Who knows? But just encourage them. When your kid comes home, make sure they do their homework, because they're going back to school and they're holding that whole class back. So there's also got to be accountability there. We even have a problem at our school where a lot of kids come with not doing their homework, so it holds everyone back. Now we're putting in policies. Obviously, we've got to make sure it's done linked to the overall allowance in the country within the policy framework. How do we punish these kids and how do we hold them accountable? And sad in that way, where the parents' intervention could be helping that kid. So you can't blame the teachers all the time. I think that's two-way. Even in the preschools, as I said, we've got 9 preschool training centres. Last year we had 190 teachers graduating through us with their SACWA NCAP level 4. This year we've got 260 teachers in the extra centre. Got 121 member preschools. As I said, we've got the biggest Marimba program in the world. So there's a lot of stuff we do, so I can use as live examples and how we bring in technology into teaching, etc. And there are ways of doing it, but you need that public-private partnership. I always say, also with business, if you look at the education budget and you look at what business is putting into education, I think it's about 3% of the actual budget. The worst thing that business can do is put money into a government program. They should be giving – the money's there. They should be helping government in a public-private partnership in helping them manage that money.
Amazing.
They should be saying yes. They should be pushing more to say to government, how are we going to fund these independent subsidized schools and in these communities, in the poorer communities? How are we going to work at bringing – all those schools in the area. So, for example, I've been in Orange Farm now since first time I walked in. There's 95.
Sure.
Our school opened in 96 from kind funding from the city of Vienna. And then there were schools and there were building schools, etc. What I've seen in the last decade is the decline of those schools. So they were coming up. And it comes around school management. If you're not going to fix school management, you're not going to fix the system. But you've also got to fix the districts. You've got to fix this. There's got to be accountability. There's got to be consequences. There's no consequence.
All this time that you have spent in the system, with the system, next to the system, you have written a book?
Yes.
I've
written a book. Very proud of my book. So it's a memoir. It's always in. Seems impossible, my fight to build and save education Africa. And I remember when I started on the book as well, one of the things that I was working with someone, obviously, is that you said you weren't born when Education Africa started. You were born once upon a time. So I open up about my own educational challenges, my own upbringing, dealing with ADHD, dealing with special needs. In those days, you were frowned upon in the 60s and 70s. What was wrong with you? I was an outpatient at Tara Children's Clinic.
Sure.
I was at Crossroads, which was lucky, but I was in a house in Parktown and they did limited subject choices. So there's things in here you'll see. But you should be able to achieve. Nothing's impossible. And my book's about my life experiences, about my work at Education Africa. And what's brilliant in the book, which is different because life's not that easy all the time. It also covers a hostile takeover of the organization by HSBC globally. HSBC?
I have to. I need to read this book.
As a corporate trustee, and then the intervention from Lord Peter Hain, who still sent another open letter to the CEO of HSBC, I saw last night. So it still continues.
He's one of my favorite activists.
So one of his letters is covered in the book, which supports the story. So my books, everything's got factual evidence, even when I was a kid. I think I'm a hoarder. I forgot it, even the report from the 1960s.
In the book.
Everything's got factual evidence.
I have 34 years of diaries. You have to leave me with this book. I have to read it, and I'm going to have you back here to come talk to me about it when I have read it, because it sounds absolutely fascinating. James, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and sharing your experience with us, and more importantly, I think, for your passion.
Thank you, Penny.
In helping us build this system, and if anything anyone takes away from this conversation today, hopefully, is how much can be done with the right people who have the right motivations, who are interested in doing the right things. Thank you.
Thank you.